And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Greg, good morning.
Good morning to you. Yeah, I kind of want to follow up on that upcoming weather forecast. In the short term, our avalanche danger remains low. It's been just so quiet the past few weeks. We had a little uptick in winds overnight, so I think if someone does get out today, they may find a few pockets of wind-drifted snow, but we're really looking ahead right now, and the current snow that is on the ground, if it's white, it's weak, which means that it will not support the weight of additional snow. So we're expecting additional snowfall Saturday, early this coming week, and as was just mentioned, it's going to come in batches, so it's going to slowly add up. So really the big picture message we want people to take from this is that expect a rising avalanche hazard beginning tomorrow. It's been low for the longest time, but it's going to change, and I'm not quite sure if it'll be moderate or considerable, at what rate it'll change, but definitely a rising avalanche hazard beginning this weekend and into next week. So definitely please pay attention to what's happening at the Utah Avalanche Center. We're trying to give you the latest updates, and just rising avalanche hazard going forward, and we really want people to be safe. We will have avalanche dangerous avalanche conditions, I think, by early this coming week.
Okay, Greg, hey, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good morning again. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Heber City Councilmember Ryan Stack. He's got an update on the NVOCZ, that is the North Village Overlay Zone, and the special meeting that was held about it on Wednesday. Then Park City Councilmember Steve Joyce with a recap of last night's meeting. Finally, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation CEO Colin Hilton with details on phase two of the UOP expansion, as well as some upcoming Olympic and UOP happenings. Stay tuned. It's 8:12 now. Good morning. Taking a look at some local news. Utah has surpassed 1,000 COVID-19 deaths since the start of the pandemic. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more on state as well as Summit and Wasatch County numbers.
The State Department of Health reported over 20 new COVID-19 deaths for the third day in a row. The 21 new deaths Thursday bring the total to 1,016 since the start of the pandemic. The department also announced just over 3,400 new COVID-19 cases on Thursday, which is lower than last Thursday when the state reported more than 3,940 new cases. Summit County saw 25 new cases, and last Thursday, for comparison, Summit reported 41. Wasatch County Health Department reported 31 new cases. Last Thursday, the county saw 49. Summit County's 7-day average for positive lab tests is currently at 16.5%, and just over 27% of tests are coming back positive on average in Wasatch County. The percent of positive test results on Thursday in the state is about 22%, and statewide, the 7-day rolling average is just over 26%, which is down from Wednesday's percentage. Utah's Department of Health reported 82 new hospitalizations Thursday. There are 554 people in the hospital for COVID-19 in the state, and almost 94% of referral center ICU beds are currently in use. 26 counties in the state, including Summit and Wasatch, are in the high-risk level of Utah's COVID-19 transmission index. There have been alterations to the original guidelines. Now, masks are required throughout the state, and limits on social gatherings are suggested, not required. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
During the recent surge of COVID-19 cases, there have been questions or complaints about how local medical and health officials are handling the COVID virus. Summit County Health Director Rich Bulla answered some of those in his recent visit to KPCW. Rick Bruff has more about that.
There have been some mixed reports about the ability of local citizens to get COVID testing from Intermountain Healthcare. At Monday's meeting of the County Health Board, some of the board members said there have been instances where locals have had contact with infected individuals, but they were told by IHC that to be tested, they had to be sick or show symptoms. Rich Boas said to clarify that he checked with the director of the Park City Hospital.
I texted Lori Weston immediately during that call, and Lori responded back that they are testing asymptomatic individuals who have been in contact with a confirmed positive case, but at 5 days out, and that's because less than 5 days, you get a high rate of false negatives. Mm-hmm. We're continuing to pursue that. What may have occurred in that particular exchange is it may have been less than 5 days when those individuals went in to get tested. So we're trying to work that out. My experience, though, has been that, I know individuals on the flip side of that coin who have been contacts and have gone in and said, I've been in contact, I'm asymptomatic, and they've been tested.
On another topic, we asked about the report that 7 businesses around Summit County were the object of complaints because they were not complying with the mask mandate. Bullis said they were given notice, but ultimately they were not fined.
Rather than shaming them into compliance, we worked with them, and they are in compliance. We've done follow-up visits, and in fact, we have pulled the notices of violation because they are in compliance. We'll continue to do inspections.
The names of the businesses have not been disclosed by the county. The results of county restaurant inspections are public record by state law. However, Bullo said those 7 businesses were not eateries. He said if a local restaurant was not obeying the mask mandate, they would make that public. Bullo added, though, that Summit County has the highest mask utilization in the state. He said that has been driven by the business community. For KPCW, I'm Rick.
Well, the Northfields development in Wasatch County includes 8 developments within the massive 8,900-acre Sorensen property there on the northern end of the Heber Valley. Heber City has also been working on an annexation plan to fold the Northfields into the city boundaries, and a special Heber City Council meeting was held on Wednesday night. On the phone to tell us what happened, I have Heber City Council member Ryan Stack. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
As I understand it, Heber City Mayor Colleen Potter called the meeting to clarify if the City Council was prepared to keep this item on the agenda for next Wednesday, December 15th. 3 council members, I believe, including yourself, want to move forward with this. Council members Heidi Franco and Rachel Kaler would like to hold off. So why is it that you think we need to move forward with this?
Well, that's a great question, Leslie. There's been a lot of good discussion about this document, and it's important to note that at the outset that this North Village Overlay Zone is fundamentally a zoning code, and there are a lot of strong, valid points that have been raised for things that we need to consider moving forward, right? Things like stormwater and water resources and availability. And I'm comfortable moving forward with the code at this point, subject to a few things I'll note in a moment, because I think that some of these other concerns are more appropriately addressed in other documents and as part of other projects, because this doesn't confer any entitlements or any densities, but it's kind of the grander visioning theme for this North Village Overlay Zone.
Councilmember Heidi Franco expressed concern about the stormwater impacts on the Provo River as well as the Heber Aquifer, and she wants a stormwater work session before she votes on this annexation code. So I guess I'm just curious, why isn't this already part of the code? I mean, apparently it's been worked on for years.
So, right, this is not an annexation document. What's contemplated and what is in this document is that any of these areas that approach the city with more than 5 acres are going to be required to enter into a master development agreement or an annexation agreement. And a lot of these issues are going to be hammered out at that time, or even in advance. I'm proposing that we get our stormwater plan together after we put the overlay zone together, but before we entertain any further action on these annexation proposals. Because this document, what it really does is it distills and applies the core principles from the Envision Heber 2050 new general plan we have. And I'm really happy to note, too, that is an award-winning plan. Later, at the end of this year, the Utah chapter of the American Planning Association conferred on our new general plan their highest achievement award. And what this overlay zone does is it incorporates those general plan principles and applies them to this North Village overlay zone. And so this functions as a zoning code about what the steps are going to look like, what's going to be required. And it even references in the latest draft that's been circulated that I saw just yesterday that any application is going to have to comply with the city's stormwater plan and MS4 requirements and best practices. And so this gives the city time to put its plan together, because no annexation can be entertained until they can show that they meet and satisfy our stormwater plan.
Okay, I guess I'm unclear then, because I had already thought that the council had approved the annexation for the Sorenson property.
So, great question. There are multiple properties up on that hillside. Sorenson is just one of them, and by land mass and unit count, it is the largest. We did enter into a master development agreement with Sorenson earlier this year, and the council did vote on that, and it did receive unanimous broad council support to annex the Sorenson area. That area sits a little higher up on the hillside and back over the ridge for about 8,500 acres, and they already had several thousand vested units with the county, and we didn't give them anything that they weren't otherwise entitled to as far as density goes with Wasatch County. But the properties that we're talking about now with this overlay zone are areas like the Highlands, like Wasatch Commons, and other areas that are having discussions with the city about possible annexations, and they're much closer down to the road by U.S. 40. Those areas have not been voted on yet.
Okay. So that we're talking about 200 acres with about seven other projects then?
I think in excess of 200 acres with the other areas we're looking at as part of this overlay zone.
All right. Council member Mike Johnston is an engineer, and he said that runoff would not be an issue for the aquifers or the Provo River. He said that it's the construction sites that cause the biggest problem. So the thinking is that these can be mitigated then as part of any conditions of approval?
Absolutely, these can be mitigated. You know, we have a unique resource here in the Heber Valley, but at the same time, we don't have to reinvent the wheel when it comes to a lot of this work that has to be done, because these are standards and concerns that have been addressed in other communities across the country. And you can take rehabilitative and mitigative measures when it comes to these construction sites. That's a lot of what's talked about in DMS-4 standards, and those are the standards we want to be looking to in the new year. And so we think that those steps can be taken, not just at the time of entering into annexation agreements, but as I propose, even before then, by getting the city a new and up-to-date stormwater plan for this area.
All right. Do the special services districts support these annexations? Apparently there was reference to a 2017 letter to the council saying that apparently some of them are concerned.
Right. So what Heber City received in 2017 was a letter from the Jordanelle Special Service District, and this was in response to this at that time the city's new proposed annexation plan, which included the expanded annexation boundary map, and that's the map that we have now. And a lot of those concerns have since been addressed. They had some concerns about our plan not complying with state code, and we did make sure that prior to adoption, it aligned with state code. The map boundaries have been modified to follow special service district boundaries, but obviously the biggest concern from the special service districts has been about the city looking to annex land, and a concern about whether any of those annexations are going to increase densities above special service district capacity. And the city's response, incorporated in that same annexation plan document, said that it's the city's intent to make sure that our land uses in our general plan have densities no greater than those already contemplated by Wasatch County as they've looked at the development of the North Village area.
All right. What are you hearing from the public about the runoff and the effect it could have on the water systems, the wells, the aquifer, the Provo River?
So the feedback we've heard so far as pertains to storm drain and runoff and things of that nature is generally right. It's concern, and it's an understandable concern. And I think a lot of it right now is we just don't know, right? Those studies have to be done. And I think in the eyes of the public, it's a big unknown, right? What's going to happen with all the storm drainage? What's going to happen with all this runoff? And so those are questions that we as the city have to be able to answer. And they're good questions, and I am encouraging the city to take the steps to answer those questions before we enter into any annexation agreements.
Yeah, your colleague Rachel Kaler said that she'd like the city to wait for a Mountainlands Association of Governments density mapping project to give the public a better understanding of the scope of the projects. Wouldn't that be a better way to get public buy-in, to wait for those? Apparently it would just take a month or two.
So that, and a lot of the Mountainland study has to do with traffic impacts, right, as well. And the challenge in waiting for that is that really deals more with the specific numbers that we might be asked to entertain as part of any unique annexation proposal. And the challenge, right, is this North Village Overlay Zone, where it is a zoning code and it is not an annexation agreement or an annexation document, is it doesn't confer any densities or any entitlements. And part of that means we don't know any specifics as to numbers as a result of this, because it just sets the vision. For example, we have in this overlay zone base densities. And the idea and what's stated is that these base densities will apply across all districts. And those base densities are low, and we pushed hard to make sure that they match the county's base densities across the entire overlay zone. And the only way that any negotiation can happen to get past those base densities into the higher density range that's expressed in the envisioned Heber document and later in the overlay zone is if the individual applicants enter into an agreement with the city to pay an additional preservation fee per ERU. And the idea is those preservation fees would go into a large preservation fund that the city could then use to try and acquire development rights with an eye on the North Fields to help preservation of open spaces. And so that highlights an important part of what this document does, but it also highlights that until we get specific proposals from developers after this overlay zone is enacted, we don't really know what the numbers are going to be. Those numbers come in the form of those annexation discussions and come in the form of what they're willing to pay for by means of this preservation fee for additional ERUs. So I support the MAG study, but I don't think it informs what happens with this zoning code. I do think it informs the discussions we have with developers as part of those annexation agreements.
All right. So it sounds like we don't really know how much density there's going to be. It sounds like there was some discussion in measuring the number of units to the number of ERUs, equivalent residential units, I guess. The Wasatch Taxpayers Association website claims that the city is changing this ERU definition, which would allow more square footage and bathrooms. And that's one way of increasing density without increasing the, quote, density numbers. Can you explain that?
So there was some discussion, right, about ERUs, and that is also in the document about how we define ERUs. Since that time, I have brought a copy of the county's ERU definition back to the council. And I am going to ask on Tuesday's meeting, when this comes up, that we incorporate the county's definition of ERUs. I think one of the concerns is that what's in this document now has removed commercial from the ERU count. And I think that comes from a well-intentioned place of wanting to encourage commercial and not penalize developers for wanting to put in commercial. But my concern with that, and I'm just speaking only for myself, my concern with removing commercial from the ERU count is it has the net impact of artificially translating those ERUs over into residential, which could increase density. And that is a concern of mine, and I want to make sure that we talk about this at our meeting, because I think we should be using the county's ERU definition.
Okay. So it sounds like we will be moving forward with this then next Tuesday?
So as you noted at our work meeting earlier this week, there was a vote by three of us who said we're willing to move forward with a vote. That was subject to a few things that we asked our consultant to go back and work on and tweak some language, and some of that I've shared here today. And assuming those changes are made to the satisfaction of a majority of the council, and assuming that we are able to incorporate the county's definition of ERUs, unless something else comes up between now and then, I would feel comfortable moving forward. So I'm comfortable moving forward, assuming some of these changes are incorporated at that meeting, or unless something else unforeseen at this point comes up.
Okay. Hey, Ryan, anything else you'd like to mention?
You know, I want to thank you for the chance to share about this morning, Leslie. I am excited about this because I do think it puts a code in place that matches and aligns with the Envision Heber principles. And we're really proud of that new general plan. And I think this is an exciting document. And I hear the public's concerns about stormwater, and they will be addressed before anything moves, before any action happens or there's any movement with any specific annexations. Right now, we're looking at one document that plays a very small piece in the overall puzzle, and that is just the zoning code. And when this is done, we'll move on to the other pieces before we can start entertaining some of these annexation applications.
Okay. I appreciate your time this morning, Ryan. Thank you. Park City Council was given an extensive update on the city's finances at last night's meeting. On the phone with a recap, I have Park City Council member Steve Joyce. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Everything from tax revenues to outstanding debt was covered. We've been getting periodic updates from the city staff all year during the pandemic, but this was really the first deep dive. Lots of topics covered. What were you, I guess, most interested in seeing here?
To me, the big thing was actually getting to see all of this in one place at one time in a fairly simplified fashion. I love what the finance team put together for this. And as Tim Henney mentioned last night, I think this is the beginning of something much cleaner that we can take to the public to really give them good information about how the city is doing financially. This was a big step up.
Park City's credit ratings were discussed. The city even has the highest possible rating from Moody's. So how does this help put the city in good position heading into 2021 and hopefully a strong recovery from the pandemic?
Well, we already got kind of a big boost when we borrowed money to build the new water treatment plant out on the 11th hole or 12th hole? Yeah, 11th hole of the golf course and 12th. And we were able to borrow the money there at just over 2%, which is just incredible. And what we heard last night is if we had to do a geo bond with our current rating, we could actually get money at a rate that's less than the cost of inflation, meaning if you borrowed money and just sat it there, and even with inflation, you'd end up ahead at the end of the time. It's just money is as close to free as I think anyone can imagine it right now. And it's because of our extremely good credit rating.
Yeah. The city has been consistently outperforming projections for sales tax revenues since the start of the fiscal year. How confident are you that those numbers can continue through the ski season?
Oh, I'm worried. To me, there's a couple of things. One is I think everybody was surprised at how well the summer went. I think the work that went on between the businesses and the Chamber of Commerce to kind of redirect our tourism business towards more drive-up traffic really worked. And we got a lot of people here. And then kind of outside of our control, we had a lot of people leaving the big cities trying to get away from COVID and thinking, you know, Park City is a safe haven and coming here. I think that really helped. But we were able to do things like the car-free Sundays. We were able to do outdoor dining. A lot of restaurants kind of switched over to taking advantage of the spaces out in front of them and beside them and things like that. Now we're in winter, and I think we're really starting to see a slowdown. I mean, people don't want to eat outside, and yeah, you can get some curbside pickup and stuff, but that's just not the same. And it would sure as hell help if it would snow out there because, you know, we want to actually get some skiers here. So I'm worried. I don't think we can look at what happened in the summer and feel comfortable about what's coming in the winter.
Since sales tax numbers are on a two-month delay, do we have any insight into how busy the Thanksgiving period was?
No, not really. I mean, there's just Becca and I just did one of our kind of walk and talks that we do where we wander up and down Main Street talking to different businesses and just see how things are going. And, you know, people definitely saw a big drop off. It was like September was great. October was pretty good. So I think we'll see good numbers from October. But November was really a big drop off to everybody we talked to. So, but it normally is, so I think it's just even a little bit worse. The question is what's really going to happen. You know, most places make their money in, you know, December through March, and so now's when it counts. I don't really, as much as I care, I really don't care about November because it doesn't make that big an impact. Now it starts to count. We're going into Christmas.
We heard the term V-shaped recovery thrown around a lot, and many of the graphs displayed last night looked pretty V-shaped in 2020. So are we experiencing a V-shaped recovery?
You know, I don't think we are yet. I mean, if you heard what the finance folks were forecasting, you know, they really, even our next fiscal year, which is July of 2021 to June of 2022, even that they don't see getting all the way back to the same financial levels that we had in fiscal year 2020, that, you know, pre-COVID. So it's going to take us a while to really recover. But I'm hopeful that, you know, now that we're starting to see vaccines getting ready to be deployed and the impact that might have, I think that could really start us towards something more like a V.
So our future debt capacity this year has taken a serious hit. And what we saw was that it really won't normalize until about 2025. So with big projects like the Arts and Culture District on the horizon, what do we need to do about that?
Well, part of it is just perspective. We actually run so low on our general obligation debts versus what the state allows. The state allows up to 4% of the total taxable value of the city. And we have put a cap, not we, but some council in days gone by put a cap that said, no, 4% is too much. Let's do 2%. And even with that 2%, we can still buy, you know, or borrow just a tremendous amount of money, you know, close to $100 million, which I wouldn't recommend by any means. So we have a lot of room in debt service. Now, it's a different question of should we, but even with the little two-year spike that we have, it's, gosh, we're so low, it's just not a big deal.
Well, the Arts and Culture District will be the main topic of discussion at Tuesday's special meeting. You've been outspoken at past meetings about funding for this project. So what do you want to see and discuss on Tuesday?
Well, so this was the first step of it. My first question was really for the Arts and Culture District. In fact, I was asking this question even almost 4 years ago when we bought the land for the Art and Culture District and I was running for city council. It's like I looked at it and went, this is going to be really, really expensive. How are we going to pay for it? And, you know, we saw some numbers and some hand waving and stuff, but I really wasn't convinced then. And quite frankly, I'm still not convinced now. I think it's a very, very expensive project. And I want to understand how we're going to pay for it, what tax money we have already available, what capital money we have sitting around, and then what we would have to do bonding wise. And at some level, the question will be, you know, some sources we can bond against just by the city council making a decision, of course, with public input, but for things like general obligation bonds, it actually has to go to a public vote. And I think, you know, my inclination is if we need to borrow a bunch of money for the Arts and Culture District, I like the idea of putting it out to the public. I like to see, you know, what their level of support is.
Okay. Let's move to special events update. Event fatigue has been something discussed even before the pandemic. And with this year turning out the way it has with really no events, how will we look at events differently going forward?
I think the most interesting comment that we had last night about events was actually, we got through this summer amazingly well. And we didn't have Tour of Utah, and we didn't have Arts Fest, and we didn't have all the sporting events, and we didn't, you know, have the music concerts. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff that didn't happen. And yet, at least from a sales tax standpoint, that's different than lodging, at least from a sales tax standpoint, we had a good summer. It was a good, healthy summer. And I don't think you can necessarily draw conclusions from that because it was such a weird, unusual year. But at the same time, it should really make us kind of doubt some of our assumptions about, you know, how critical events are to the success or failure of the city. I think we learned that at least in 1 year, we had a decent summer and we had, as you described it, almost no events at all.
Yeah. So there doesn't seem to be much of an appetite for Triple Crown. How come? Am I the only softball fan here in Park City?
Oh, I think there's a mix. I mean, we've heard Max talk about how important he thinks it is. I'm not a terribly big fan. To me, when we went through the special events work about, what was that, two and a half years ago now, and we're looking at kind of the whole event fatigue, event mitigation work, we really started to notice the difference between some of the things that were truly local, either locally valuable, like the Halloween parade and things, are not parade, but, you know, the dog parade, Miner's Day, things like that. But there were other things where, you know, we bring in 1,000 softball teams and it's players and families and all that kind of thing. And yeah, sure enough, there's some people, locals, who go and watch kind of thing. But from a standpoint of really being a locals event, you know, you'll have 1,000 teams and, you know, 5 of them will be local or something like that. It's just not a local event. And that was one of the things we heard quite a bit of feedback on when we went through the whole event fatigue pieces, focus on the things that are either really low impact but financially strong for the community, or things that have a lot of community value. And so that's going to be part of the debate is, you know, for some people, they probably go out and watch a ton of softball games. But in general, you know, if you stop by and watch one of those, you'll see it's mostly parents and family and things like that that came traveling with the kids.
Yeah, but these are still the families that, you know, go and eat at our pizza parlors and stay in our less expensive rental units. So are you saying that Park City can only be a playground for the rich?
Oh, no, not at all. I certainly don't think that that's the case. I think the question is, we always are going to have a balancing act between the impact that events have and the value that we get out of them. And if you use the argument of, well, it brings in revenue and it fills lodging, then you would say yes to every event forever. So I don't think anybody would argue that we need to say yes to every event forever. So the question is, how do you make those decisions? And I guarantee you, you know, with 5 council people and the mayor in the room, you're going to get 5 different opinions. So it'll be interesting because we have some contracts coming up over the next year for Silly Market, for Triple Crown. I think Arts Festival's coming back up. So we'll have those discussions, but certainly didn't touch on them last night. Last night was mostly just about a heads up from the special events group, kind of letting us know what was coming, what happened last year, and kind of reinforcing the idea that we really do, it does cost the city a tremendous amount of money through not only with fee waivers, but kind of the hidden costs of events that, you know, I think the number I saw was about $500,000 beyond the fee waivers that we do.
All right. I just have another minute left, but quickly, the council did adopt new impact fee ordinances. It's been quite a few years, apparently, since they were last updated. City Manager Matt Dias says that these impact fees are complex and often quite litigious. You expressed some frustration, though, with how some of the fees are structured when it comes to single-family versus multifamily buildings. So how flexible are these fees when it comes to affordable housing?
So if you truly take the deed-restricted affordable housing, the answer is they're very flexible because we can actually completely waive the fee. What was worrying me was not the ones that are the deed-restricted houses, but some of the, I'll call them the less expensive apartments and condos that aren't targeted for, you know, ski-in, ski-out kinds of, you know, 3,000-square-foot condos, but the ones people live in over in Prospector or things like that. And I was worried about those that aren't deed-restricted, but this just becomes an extra burden on them. And they can, in fact, apply to have their fees reduced, but that's a pretty onerous process. And I was hoping we could get a little bit more flexibility than we have.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Steve?
No, I think that's it. The weather forecast says we might get snow, so I'm just all excited and fingers crossed.
Okay. Park City Council Member Steve Joyce, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, earlier this week, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission unanimously approved the Utah Olympic Park's Phase 2 project of ski run and ski lift improvements. On the phone with details, I have the CEO of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Colin Hilton. Good morning.
Good morning, Wesley.
So what does Phase 2 entail?
That is moving over to what we call the West Peak, just to the right as you look at the bobsled track looking uphill. this would be a next phase of what we call our mountain expansion project. And this would create two runs from the top of the peak and provide a full-length giant slalom training runs, as well as a slalom and moguls run.
Okay. And then an additional ski lift?
Yes. This would be a roughly 3,500-foot-long used fixed grip, much like our partners at Deer Valley helped us with the first lift. We would be sourcing a used lift coming out and installing a fixed grip lift to the top of this peak.
Okay, and then the first phase expansion had a one chair lift, and then what? Just what kind of run, training runs?
Used very much to sort of double the length of what we had for alpine training, as well as putting in a much longer moguls run on what we call the intermediate hill, which has been very active over the last several weeks. We were so excited to get that open on November 17th, and it's pretty much full and booked almost every day, all day. And it's just we're trying to match the demand that our young athletes of all ages and all abilities are having in the various sports of alpine and freestyle on these mountain expansion projects.
Yeah, and I think it was, what, three entities, or were you the fourth, the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation? I mean, Park City Ski and Snowboard, University of Utah, what, and who?
And Romark.
Romark.
Ski Academy.
So
yeah.
Has all of the money been raised? I mean, or do we have more money to raise?
We've got more to go. So this was the approval of phase two, and we're still, we're about three quarters of the way through phase two funding. It's about an $8 million total project cost with two, we've got about $5.5 million raised to that. So we are, $2.5 million that we're still seeking and very much hoping to be able to do that so that we can start construction next summer.
All right. So the Legacy Foundation is then kind of fronting the money, or?
Well, on phase one, we had all the parties pitching in, and that was roughly about a $4 million effort. Each of the Park City Ski and Snowboard and Romark Ski Academy put in $1 million each on that. And the Legacy Foundation put in roughly $2 million towards phase one. So overall, we're looking between phase one and phase two at about $12 million total in project cost expense, and we're about $2.5 million still to go to get to that total amount.
Okay, so you're not expecting to get paid back. You're a partner in this.
We're a partner, and again, this is the effort and the amazing what we call our resident clubs who have helped us privately raise funding to pay for this endeavor, with the Legacy Foundation putting in about $2 million.
Okay. Does somebody get top priority over the use of the facilities?
Well, the three resident clubs, being Romark, Park City, Ski and Snowboard, and University of Utah, are, if you will, the for the contribution, they get priority. We do have other clubs that are using our facility from everywhere from Snowbird to Snow Basin to obviously Wasatch Freestyle is another local club, but priority access is for the resident clubs.
Sounds like a logistical nightmare.
That's why Matt Twilliger does an awesome job for us managing those schedules.
All right. Well, a big part of that is the fact that there's going to be night skiing allowed, unlike what we've got at Park City Mountain. So you had said at the Planning Commission meeting, you always get asked, why the lights? What's the answer?
Well, for most of our user groups, they're in school till about 3 o'clock. And as we know, in the winter period, it's getting dark about 4:30, 5 o'clock. So it's absolutely imperative. We've had lights up here ever since we opened back in 1993 on what we at the time called small hills. And now we've got an intermediate hill. The bobsled track has lights, and we're regular programming up to about 8 to 9 o'clock at night on the bobsled track in Intermediate Hill. And so I'm the train that would be a ribbon of lighted terrain, because the kids absolutely need to be able to see and be able to train at a time of day that allows them to stay in school.
Planning commissioners asked how we should compare the lights that you're proposing to Woodward, where there have been a number of complaints.
Well, we've got a couple of good things going for us. In a relative sense, we're much more set back from highways and roadways, so we're a little further in the distance, so it's not as upfront as people pass by. And it's also the evolution of sport lighting has allowed us to be able to provide the performance needed for the safety of the racers as they make turns, but also to have a light coloring and things that's a little more, if you will, a softer white light as opposed to a daylight, very white, washed out light. So we think it'll be more closer to what you saw as you come into town on the old payday run that over at Park City Mountain Resort that provides what we think is a unique look. And our view is I look up the mountain and I see the lights on and I'm smiling, because that means kids are off their couch, they're on the mountain, they're training, they're getting exercise, and that's, to me, what we need more of in these days.
During the public hearing, a couple of Sunpeak residents asked how the lighting will affect their neighborhood. Is that going to be the case? Will they be impacted?
No, because most of these runs are facing towards Ecker Hill and Kibble Junction. The lighting, they may see the top of the mountain, but there is no light, what they call light trespass, into the properties behind us.
All right. And then you have promised to shut the lights off by 9 o'clock, though you could keep them on later?
Yeah, our development agreement from a while back allows us up to 11, but, for our user groups, they really are done no later than 9. So much as people see when they come by Kimball Junction, our lights on the current facilities are always usually done by 8 or 9 o'clock, and we don't see that changing.
All right. Phase 3 is also contemplated. What would happen then?
That's just expanding the terrain to allow additional training lanes and more disciplines for more of our free ski and potential different discipline training areas. And that's just not totally defined yet, but we've got some added terrain that will help with as we grow over time.
So would that include more lifts and lights or just lanes?
No more lifts, and to be determined on the lights. We're not quite scoped out phase 3 yet, and that'll be a discussion when we come back to a planning commission meeting.
Okay. And when do you expect phase 3 would be proposed?
Probably not for a little while, to be honest. We're going to get the bulk of what is the current demand for probably the next 5 years or so. So this would be probably in the 5 to 10 year horizon.
All right. Wanted to ask you about the Continental Cup that's starting today at the UOP and Soldier Hollow, but no spectators. Is that going to be the case for all events at the UOP and Olympic Games?
Pretty much yes is an unfortunate answer, but we've been working very diligently with our local health departments, with Rich and his team, and with the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, the NGBs. We are just thrilled that we can be training athletes and having some form of competitions, but we also want to be very respectful to the safety protocols and reducing any potential transmissions by having spectators. So it's unfortunate, but it's the times we live in at the moment.
Yeah. How many other events are being planned for the winter?
There's, as this whole year has been in 2020, we have desires potentially to do a moguls event in February. We have an aerials event potentially in January, but these are primarily sort of regional and national events and not
so much on the international side.
Okay. And any news with regard to the Olympic front? Still thinking about 30 or 34, right?
Yep. You know, it's one of those things. I know you talked to Cindy just a few weeks ago. We are very much doing lots of work behind the scenes, but there's not a lot going to happen on the public side for this, probably through Tokyo Games next summer. We do view that we're probably even more attractive as a location, given the fact that we have the facilities already built and we've got athletes training every day, and we have genuine support in our region to doing this. So a little bit of the interesting coordination for us is looking at the back-to-back nature of an LA Games in 28 and a Utah Games in 30. And a lot of the focus is on budget and making sure that we can do this in a very prudent, efficient way. We think we can. We're probably doing more budget planning 10 years in advance than I think I've ever done at a major event. But it's through the prudent leadership and of Fraser Bullock that we are absolutely on top of this. And I think making sure the public understands that a future Games is going to be privately funded. It's not going to be coming from taxpayer funding. We are very much looking to have this be something more than a three-week sporting event, that it can be a catalyst for local government and state government to provide initiatives that could help on public transportation, to air quality, to net zero goals. Those are, for me, the fun things beyond hosting the Games, which is the priority of putting on a great athletic event. But we very much are focused with the idea of a future Games to have this benefit even those who don't really care about the sporting event itself. And that's the exciting thing with both our Park City and Summit County leadership. We're going to be digging into that along with every community around Utah about how we can position a very effective, exciting, financially prudent, and exciting game to advance even some local visionary goals.
Okay, I just got a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about how that athlete workforce housing is working out.
It's been great. We have everything from athletes and coaches and employees of UOP. We're pretty much full on all of our year-round apartments. About two-thirds of the building is for year-round living apartments, and about 60 beds in about 30 rooms are for short-term housing. That's been really the thing that's been a little bit challenging through this pandemic period, but we do have athletes coming mainly from within the U.S. Coming and being able to use the housing to be able to come train and be up at a place like UOP or even staying here for going over to Soldier Hollow. So we're excited. It's doing exactly what we hoped, and I'm glad we got onto that when we did.
Okay. Hey, appreciate your time, Colin. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Leslie. Have a good day.